Garland called the Resource Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, February 29, 2016. Good afternoon. Welcome, and let the record show that the House Resources Committee was convened at 1:02 p.m. Representative Josephson, Representative Seaton, Representative Harper, Vice Chair, my fellow co-chair, Representative Taylor Tallarico, myself, Representative Benny Noyak. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your cell phones. Hello, Summers from House Records. Is that your name?
That's
Summers?
Correct.
Okay. Hello to Matt from LIO. Today we will continue our work on House Bill 247, and we'll hear invited testimony from oil and gas industry, primarily from the North Slope. We'll try to get through all of the scheduled presenters this afternoon, but if we run out of time, we will start again at 6 o'clock p.m. Also, if the presenters have written testimony, please be sure to provide that to my staff, and we'll distribute that to committee members and the public. Welcome to Ms. Moriarty from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, AOGA. Please come forward, identify yourself for the record, and begin. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's nice to see you, Chairman Nagyak, Co-Chair Tallarico, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kara Moriarty, and I'm the President and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
For you, go any further, President Representative Olson and Representative Tarr, proceed.
The Alaska Oil and Gas Association is commonly referred to as AOGA. We are the professional trade association whose mission is to foster the long-term viability of the oil and gas industry in Alaska, which does benefit all of Alaska. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House Bill 247, Governor Walker's oil and gas tax policy proposal. As you can see, AOGA represents a wide range of oil and gas producers, explorers, refiners, marketers, and transporters of oil and gas in the state of Alaska. Our current members include Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Blue Crest Energy, BP, Kalis Energy, Chevron, ExxonMobil, Hillcorp, PetroStar, Shell, and Tesoro. And although I am here on behalf of a variety and diverse group of companies, my testimony today represents the thoughts and sentiments of each and every member company. And especially on matters of tax, AOGA requires unanimous consent of this testimony. And before I address the bill before you, I believe it is prudent to discuss the current state of the oil and gas industry in Alaska. In order for each of you to make an informed decision, it is important to understand and appreciate the industry from a context broader than tax revenue.
For the record, Representative Johnson is present.
Sure.
Proceed.
Can I ask a question at the onset?
Yes, you may.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity. Kara, I want to take this moment to, advise you that I think this is really more important than just a testimony. As you'd say, you're here to give public testimony, invited public testimony. We as a body sitting at this table were advised by the administration that we were to get and to take all of our impact analysis on this bill from you. We were to rely on what industry told us. So I want to emphasize that what you say today is particularly important because, and I see Mr. Alper nodding his head, yes, we are to get our impact analysis and to understand how this bill will impact this industry from the folks testifying here today and later on in this week. So I think this is, it puts a level of seriousness to this testimony that we've not often had in this building, and I just, you know, advise you of that.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Hawker, and we will touch on that, and I will take this testimony very serious. I am probably going to exceed my 20 minutes as suggested time by the chair for that very reason. And I will talk about the impact in broad terms, and then I have a lot of companies behind me that will talk specifically about how this bill impacts their specific company. So moving forward, the state revenue depicted on this table represents the total state revenue generated in fiscal year 2015, both restricted and unrestricted revenue. The unrestricted portion of the $2.3 billion that you see on the screen was $1.7 billion, which represented 75% of the state's total unrestricted revenues this last fiscal year. In addition, the industry paid $447 million in property taxes to local governments. Again, for greater context, I believe you heard a similar presentation about industry impact from the mining industry last week, and the mining industry generates $83 million in state revenue and pays $18 million in taxes to local governments. It would also be imprudent to discuss the oil and gas industry's contribution to Alaska without mentioning jobs. Based on the most recent data from the McDowell Group report on jobs and wages in the industry, and from data in the 2015 Department of Revenue Revenue Sources book, the oil and gas industry is, without question, a main driver in Alaska's economy. When you combine jobs from direct industry employers like AOGA members, plus the jobs provided from indirect industry employers, such as the multitude of Alaska-based contractors, plus the induced jobs created by those employees when they spend money in their communities, there are 51,000 private sector jobs that can be contributed to the oil and gas industry in Alaska. The McDowell Group then modeled the number of state employees and other jobs and their wages created in Alaska's economy through state spending, acknowledging that the overwhelming majority of that spending is attributable to the oil and gas industry.
For the record, Representative Heron is here.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
The McDowell Group found that an additional 60,000 public sector jobs would not exist without the industry's fiscal contributions. All told, the McDowell Group concluded that 111,000 jobs generating $6.45 billion in wages result from the oil and gas industry's presence in Alaska. Again, by comparison, the mining industry generates about 8,700 jobs. To put it in more simple terms, more than one-third of Alaska's jobs are tied to the oil and gas industry. For every direct job the industry provides, so every person who testifies today, they work directly for the industry. So for every person who testifies today, that job creates 20 additional jobs throughout Alaska's economy. The McDowell Group will tell you that no other industry comes even close to that magnitude of multiplier effect. Finally, you have undoubtedly heard and read headlines regarding the industry being forced to lay off direct employees in this current low-price environment. It is not just oil industry families that are dealing with the adverse effects of downsizing. Contractions in the industry are felt across the state, as every dollar earned by an oil and gas employee, so for every dollar in wages, for an oil and gas direct employee, that dollar generates eight additional dollars in wages throughout the state of Alaska. So it is easy to be cynical, to tell anecdotal stories about getting on an airplane next to a worker who lives out of state, coming or going from the North Slope. And although the industry, for a variety of reasons, cannot dictate where an individual must live, companies consistently strive to hire as many eligible Alaskans as possible. The statewide average for all resident hire across all industries, according to the most recent Department of Labor report, is 80% Alaska hire. So that's across Alaska, all industries, about 80% are Alaskans. Many AOGA member companies actually have a much higher rate of resident hire than the statewide average. For example, Kalis Energy has more than 85% Alaska hire and over 400 contractors working on the slope this year. Alyeska has a 94% Alaska hire rate, with 20% of that 94 being of Alaska Native heritage. 100% of Blue Crest operations staff are Alaska residents, while 70% of the construction workers at their Cosmopolitan project are state residents. And PetroStar boasts 97% Alaska hire. In 2014, which is the most recent data that we have, BP spent $2.2 billion in Alaska, with 72% of that spend with Alaska companies. And they currently have a 79% Alaska hire rate. ExxonMobil has engaged and worked with more than 100 Alaska companies in their construction of Point Thompson, 80% of which are Alaskans. 89% of Hillcorp's workforce are Alaskans. In addition to this, the industry very much supports scholarships and training programs to increase the resident hire. For example, Alyeska alone spends $2 million each year to hire, train, and develop Alaska Native employees. Would the industry like to hire more Alaskans? Absolutely. Of course we would. It makes good business sense to hire Alaskans, as it is both more efficient and economical to do so. What does not make good business sense is the provision in Section 27 of the bill in front of you, which would limit the repurchase of refundable credits to just a percentage of the credit or the certificate equal to that company's percentage of Alaska resident hire in the previous calendar year, including Alaska hire by the company's contractor workforce. Basing the repurchase of tax credits on a company's local hire percentage would make it difficult, if not impossible, for operators to plan and evaluate investments because their contractors' and subcontractors' Alaska hire percentages are outside of the operator's control. This uncertainty will, in turn, discourage potential new investment here. In addition, a resident hire limitation on the amount of an otherwise well-earned tax credit certificate that can be cashed out also raises significant issues under the United States Constitution. And an earlier Alaska hire preference attached to the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. The inevitable legal battle would drag out in court, and the unanswered question would cloud Alaska's tax system with uncertainty until there was a ruling. We would like to note that the U.S. Supreme Court recently heard oral arguments involving an Alaska issue, a very important one, the Sturgeon case. And that took about 9 years for that case to wind its way through the legal system to reach the highest court. Does Alaska want to create further uncertainty over local hire? Finally, if it is good policy to put local hire conditions on how the oil and gas industry is taxed, one might expect similar proposals for other industries operating in Alaska. But the administration isn't proposing anything like that, even though some industries employ much higher rates of non-Alaskans than ours. So as I already indicated, Alaska's oil and gas industry is a main contributor to state government, both in terms of revenue generated for state spending, as well as the jobs created by the industry. You can see from this table that since statehood, oil and gas has been the source for 85% of the state's unrestricted revenue, totaling just over $140 billion. And I think it's important to note that that $140 billion figure has not been adjusted for inflation over the last almost 40 years. So in today's dollars, the total would actually be far greater if that number would be adjusted for inflation. As you discuss the change in Alaska's oil and gas tax policy, this slide is a reminder, maybe painful for some of us, a painful reminder that in the last decade, there have already been five major changes in tax policy. As the president of Hilcorp stated last week, and I quote, "I started in the oil business right straight out of school during the real boom in the 70s, early 80s in Midland, Texas. I'm not aware of the fiscal system ever changing in the state of Texas since I've been working in the oil and gas industry. I've been in Alaska 4 years, and we've debated it 3 or 4 times. Unquote. He went on to say, "More than anything, changing rules and taxes every few years is a sure way to scare investment away." Of course, the last major change in tax policy occurred 3 years ago with the passage of Senate Bill 21, followed by the referendum to repeal the new law in August of 2014. Voters decided the state's current fiscal policy was good for Alaska, and we would agree that Alaska has proved to be competitive, has attracted new jobs and investment, and will ultimately result in more production to the state. I think this is important to note. Since April of 2013, when the bill passed the legislature, industry has announced more than additional $5 billion in additional investment across the state. That's $5 billion more since April of 2013. That increased spending could not have happened at a better time, frankly, as the investments made in the last 18 to 24 months are helping the industry sustain itself in this low-price environment. But what about production? What has the increased investment meant in terms of production? As you can see from this chart, using data again from the Department of Revenue Sources book, production on the North Slope has stabilized and is forecasted to be relatively flat from last fiscal year to this fiscal year, which is particularly significant when considering an historical trend of 5 to 6% annual decrease. The state's own forecast shows the power of a competitive fiscal system. So if you look at the chart, the blue line is the historical production in Alaska for the last decade. The black line is the forecast from the Fall Revenue Sources book in 2013, which is really the last forecast when we were under the ACES regime. And the red line is the forecast from just this past December. So if you look to the chart that we put together on the right and look out a few years, so let's say to 2020, so in 5 years from now, and compare this year's forecast to the forecast released in the fall of 2013, you can see after approximately 2 years under this new tax system, the Department of Revenue is forecasting 50,000 barrels a day more than what they were forecasting in 2013. And I think to provide further context, the price forecast in the fall of 2015, which was just a couple months ago, is $50 a barrel less than the price forecast in the fall of 2013 for the year 2020. So, even with a much lower price forecast, the production forecast is still 50,000 barrels greater than it was just 2 years ago. There's also been a lot of conversation about new oil, or oil that qualifies for the gross value reduction, or the GVR. And as a reminder, when Senate Bill 21 was passed, the purpose of the GVR was to lower the effective tax rate on new production as a way to incentivize that production. Some have recently asserted that all oil after 2002 will pay zero taxes if prices are under $70 per barrel. And I will discuss government take on all oil, including GVR, later in my testimony and presentation. But I would just like to point out this slide, that the Department of Revenue is forecasting that GVR oil, the new oil, will average about 8% of our overall production for the next 15 years. So while bringing on new fields and new oil is important to Alaska's future, it's our legacy fields that will continue to provide the lion's share of production for years to come, and they do not qualify most of this production will not qualify for the gross value reduction. So looking to Cook Inlet, you will see a tremendous production success story. The Division of Oil and Gas Director Corey Feige mentioned these statistics during her presentation last week. You can see there has been an increase of over 100% since 2009. And the investments made to increase Cook Inlet production have made a significant impression on the local economy. Additionally, our member company Tesoro refines every barrel of oil possible that travels the short distance to their refinery. A December 2015 econ study report for the Senate Finance Committee, which was recently released, reported that Alaska refineries supply the majority of the state's demand in the South Central and Interior regions. When oil production was lower in Cook Inlet, the Tesoro refinery was importing oil to refine from as far away as Africa. I was astounded when I heard that from Tesoro. They had to do that just to meet these in-state needs. Econ One also went on to say, and I quote from the report, "We estimate that the total value added to Alaska's economy by the two refineries currently in operation, PetroStar and Tesoro, is approximately $150 million per year," unquote. In comparison, the governor recently announced the impact of the marine highway system is just under that, at $100 million per year. So the ferry system has an economic impact of $100 million, and our two in-state refineries has a benefit of $153 million. The report went on to say, and I quote, "The refining industry provided $23 million in revenue annually to the state in the form of revenue in kind, commonly referred to as RIK, purchases over and above the revenue in value, or the RIV alternative, and $9.3 million in property and income taxes," unquote. So having a local source of supply for the refinery is good for value-added manufacturing in our state. Now, unfortunately, it is impossible to have this conversation without acknowledging the ominous and unprecedented drop in oil prices. Prices today are not only the lowest we've seen in a decade, but when adjusted for inflation, they are the lowest we've seen since the mid-1980s. In less than 2 years, the industry has experienced over a 70% drop in oil prices. You are well aware of this impact and what it has had on the state of Alaska revenues. You have historically received 85 to 90% of your revenue from oil. As significant as that is, it's important to recognize that the industry receives 100% of its revenue based on the market price for what it produces. And as my friends in other industries will tell you, specifically one of my friends in the commercial fishing industry will say this, he will say, "We are price takers, not price makers." Every industry operating in Alaska fully understands that Alaska is an expensive and logistically challenging place to do business. I imagine that concept was also expressed last week by the mining industry, and it is particularly true for the oil and gas industry as well. The chart you see before you demonstrates that while the oil and gas development costs grew 90%, so costs grew 90% in the last 15 years since 2000, but inflation grew only 40% during that same period. So in other words, over the past 15 years, costs have surged more than two times the rate of inflation. This is yet another compelling factor and financial stressor on industry in Alaska, which compounds the difficult decisions these companies are making to cut costs and increase efficiencies while safely and reliably producing oil and gas. So invariably, companies are forced to operate despite the current oil price environment, and this can result in projects being delayed and deferred. Perhaps most painfully, it also results in Alaskan jobs being lost. This chart shows the relationship between the low price that I showed you two slides ago on slide 11, or 12, I believe, and the high cost that I just showed you. It looks eerily similar to the charts you as policymakers are reviewing in terms of the state's revenue and expenses. The oil and gas industry is cash flow negative, at least as much as the state sees itself as being. And as I alluded to before, the high-cost environment in Alaska is even more difficult to navigate during this unprecedented low-price environment. Again, all of this information on the chart comes from the Department of Revenue Sources book, and it shows that the estimated cost of producing a barrel of oil on the North Slope before a company pays a penny in tax is $52 a barrel. So the slide shows downstream costs, the transportation costs total about $10.56 a barrel. And then we have royalty, our operating expenditures are $18.48, our capital expenditures are $17 a barrel. So all told, before any taxes, not just production taxes, it costs about $52 a barrel. One need not be an economist or a Rhodes Scholar to understand that in a $30 a barrel world with $52 costs, oil companies are in a very untenable position in Alaska. And despite this, here we are testifying about legislation to add additional costs to the industry by raising the production tax. It is not surprising that the Division of Oil and Gas Director Corey Feige testified last week that companies are gravely concerned about any substantial changes to policy, and they're going to talk about their specific concerns over the next several days. But to quote Director Feige, she said, "Changes in taxes generally are lumped into the bucket of cost. At a time when prices are low, that sets off some alarm bells," unquote. Intuitively, it seems like poor long-term policy to choose to increase the costs of the industry at a time when the industry's spending is already out of balance with their revenues by over $20 a barrel before they pay existing taxes. If additional taxes are levied on the industry, forcing them to be even more out of balance, you can be sure that the industry would have to make more severe cuts in expenditures that are needed to maintain and grow the state's production. The Department of Revenue tax director suggested to me a few weeks ago that if industry were to simply eliminate all capital expenditures, so if you look, the $17.68 a barrel, the industry would basically be able to quote-unquote break even at these prices. This astonishing suggestion discounts the significant role that capital investment plays for maintenance and the integrity of industry operations. Absent continued spending, especially capital spending, the state can say goodbye to the currently forecasted additional 50,000 barrels per day in 2020. As misguided as that line of thought might be, it does highlight the fundamental question at the core of this discussion. How badly are you willing to mortgage Alaska's future for nominal and short-term gains today? It will be very challenging for the industry to reduce operating expenses, because really the industry will have two choices. They can't really control the transportation costs. They are what they are. So they'll have to take additional taxes out of operating or capital. Capital will impact investment spend, and that will impact production. Operating expenditures, it will be very difficult for the industry to reduce operating expenses without further reductions in the workforce. It's just the reality in this price environment. So any increase will have a negative impact on the industry and on the state's future. So as you weigh yet another alter in tax policy, there are policy questions that need to be answered. What effect will the policy have on overall production in the state? Will the policy make Alaska more or less competitive on a global scale? Will the policy provide stability to the industry and to the state? And will the policy provide predictability? The Department of Revenue has frequently said the industry will be testifying, and I think Representative Hawker mentioned it at the beginning, that we would be testifying to the impact of their proposed changes. And as I mentioned, I have no doubt each company will do that. But I encourage you, as they testify, to ask them these four questions over the next several days. So, as we look at House Bill 247, the administration's proposal represents the sixth major tax change in the last 11 years. Prior changes came from unprecedented high oil prices. Prices were skyrocketing. The state wanted more. Or the changes endeavored to incentivize development in the state and make Alaska more competitive. However, the motivation this time behind this current proposal is not to improve the fiscal system for the industry or create incentives for further development and increased production. Rather, it is purely driven for the state's desire for more money, especially now in this in your budget situation. And Director Alper mentioned that 2 weeks ago, that it is a tax increase, and they don't think that they are attempting to disguise that. So raising prices, or raising taxes rather, when prices go up, and then raising them again when prices go down, undercuts stability and predictability. The administration acknowledges the industry is suffering tough economic times. In fact, according to their testimony last week, if prices average around $40 a barrel for 2016, and keep in mind the average for January was 30, if prices average around 40, the industry will suffer more than $1 billion quote-unquote loss in the state of Alaska. So that means if the state keeps the current structure and does nothing, spending $1 billion more than the industry is taking in, that alone will have a negative impact on Alaska's economy, considering the state is the largest private economic driver in Alaska. Yet it is clearly the intention of the state to raise taxes on an industry with negative cash flow, and not by small margins. To add another $500 million of impact to the industry with the passage of House Bill 247 will only accelerate cutbacks by the industry, which will affect the number of Alaskans working, the amount of cash that circulates through the economy, and ultimately the future health and growth of the industry. Under Governor Hammond, Alaska first established the theory of an equitable policy on government take. And Governor Hammond established that one-third government take should be for the state of Alaska, one-third for the federal government, and the last third for industry. So during the Aisha's regime, government take climbed to a higher level, which in turn led directly to Senate Bill 21 in an effort to normalize total government take over a broad range of prices. And as Janik Mayer from Analytica explained last week, with the slide that Representative Josephson said he was going to hang on his wall for government take, that government take is about 62% in a price range from $60 to $150, including government take on new oil. The GVR oil is included in that figure. So contrary to Director Alper's testimony 2 weeks ago, House Bill 247 increases government take. In fact, Mr. Mayer demonstrated and explained that, quote, the cumulative impact of the proposed changes would be to shift up government take and lower oil prices. In times like today, the effective government take exceeds 100%, unquote. And Representative Josephson, we thought you summarized it very well, that the industry is suffering so much that we, the state, will get all the money in this proposal. So 2 weeks ago, AOGA submitted specific comments for each section of the bill that causes the industry concern. And in the interest of time, I'm not going to belabor each and every section. There's 40 of them in the bill. However, I do want to comment on a few of the substantial concerns that we have with the bill. First of all, the governor's proposal would increase the minimum gross tax from 4 to 5%. And while a 1 percentage point increase might not sound significant to some, in reality, it represents at least a 25% increase for those companies who already pay the 4% minimum tax. Additionally, the governor's proposal would forbid companies from using any earned or available tax credits to reduce the minimum tax below the new 5% floor. It is likely there will be companies, large and small, that have earned new oil tax credits, or exploration, drilling, or tax loss credits from prior investments, while also operating in a loss position due to this low price environment. For those companies, using those tax credits is the only way they can continue to invest in the state. The proposal would delay or possibly deny economic recovery at the very time the companies need it the most. So, in other words, raising the minimum tax affects everyone, and the proposed increase is large enough to cause substantial negative impacts on all producers at today's oil prices. In our view, that is poor tax policy to engage in nothing more than, in our view, a flagrant money grab at a time when the state should be encouraging industry to continue making vital investments. But that's for the companies who are already paying the minimum tax. For smaller companies or newcomers to the state who have yet to make a profit in Alaska, they don't pay the 4% minimum tax now. So under the governor's proposal, they would go from paying zero in production tax because they don't make a profit to immediately being hit with a 5% gross tax, a punitive tax increase described by Director Alper as a quote-unquote infinite increase. So additionally, the proposal would change the way the minimum tax is determined and would prevent a producer from taking the actual tax credits available for a month to the extent they are greater than initially estimated for. So both of these incremental changes amount to a fundamental change in how the tax is calculated, and both result in a tax increase. Another major concern deals with the net operating loss tax credits. And I imagine that each company has a different view on the net operating loss credits and why they're important to them. The administration has testified that they are preserving the NOL credit, but we contend that under the current proposal, the NOL credits become virtually useless. NOL tax credits are utilized both on the North Slope and in Cook Inlet, and they were established to help level the playing field for new companies trying to get a foothold in Alaska. The NOL tax credits allow all companies making critical investments to truly understand the economics under which those investments were made. And under Senate Bill 21, the NOLs provide an even level of government support for capital investments on the very expensive North Slope. House Bill 247 would prevent the use of the NOL tax credits to reduce the minimum tax. Now, this change is analogous to the federal government not allowing a company's losses to be applied against its corporate income tax. Additionally, the proposal imposes a 10-year limit for a company to apply unused NOL credits. Now, even though the NOL credits can be deferred, it essentially changes their value. And the deferral itself is a tax increase because they were not expecting to have to pay that same level of tax if prices dropped. And if they defer the NOL credit to be applied in a future year, they have to pay the tax, though, in the current year. So without question, changing the value and the use of the credit, the NOL credit, will have a tremendous impact on companies in Alaska. There are several other changes proposed to credits, both for the North Slope and Cook Inlet. Setting arbitrary limits of $25 million per company, even when the smallest of projects range in the $500 million to $1 billion range. That is unreasonable and will be a strong disincentive for future investment. Eliminating or discouraging cash rebates for companies that may not yet have production or profits strongly discourages and disadvantages new companies, especially considering when they invested in good faith based on tax policy in place when the investments were committed. For the state to basically say, after the fact, that it is not going to fund its share of the new developments as originally promised is just wrong and potentially puts some of these new companies out of business. Eliminating two important credits for Cook Inlet and quote-unquote Middle Earth, as we call it, is also dangerous. as especially in Cook Inlet, the drilling tax credits were unequivocally the driver for several key investments in the region that have already led to increased production and jobs. The state has benefited from smaller, new companies to the state, making new discoveries that would positively increase the state's future revenues from royalties and taxes on that new production. These credits are not a cost. They are an investment by the state with a good return. Companies have already entered into contracts and made large financial contributions for spending over at least this next calendar year. Abruptly terminating those credits after they have made those substantial good faith estimate investments and commitments over the next year is bad faith on the state's part and will chill these types of investments in the future. We also fundamentally disagree that Cook Inlet has, quote, gas in search of a market, unquote, as has been asserted by the administration. The Department of Revenue, the Department of Natural Resources, and Analytica have all testified that additional investments are necessary to meet the increasing demand of Alaska's residents. Without continued investment, gas production will rapidly decline, and any decline will inevitably result in higher utility rates for consumers and increase the likelihood of gas shortages. There is a provision that I want to discuss now that was not part of our position paper a couple of weeks ago, and that is the proposed revisions in Section 39 of House Bill 247 of the bill, which define outstanding liability to the state in very broad terms, and I quote from the bill. So any outstanding liability will be defined as an amount of tax, interest, penalty, fee, rental, royalty, or other charge for which the state has issued a demand for payment that has not been paid when due, and if contested, has not been finally resolved against the state, unquote. So that means the state could deny or delay tax credit payments for virtually any outstanding and alleged liability, regardless of whether it is pending adjudication. So if a taxpayer had an existing dispute with a state agency unrelated to taxes, it could be deemed as an outstanding liability to the state and the tax credit used to satisfy that liability. Or if an audit was pending, the tax credit could be delayed until the conclusion of the audit. This revision, absent further clarification or modification, would provide the state with the power to arbitrarily deny or delay any tax credit or to apply them against unresolved or unrelated disputes, including those utilized by in-state refineries. So this provision could have a specifically large impact on both of our refineries. And according to the report that I mentioned by Econ One earlier, they were quoted as saying, Alaska's refineries are relatively small in size and technologically simple. This puts Alaska refineries at a disadvantage relative to larger, more efficient refineries, which becomes greater when refinery utilization outside the state drops, meaning that refiners have spare production capacity. Refiners of Alaska's size and complexity are generally the first to close or idle units in this environment. So, keeping that in mind, in this price environment, it's very challenging for refineries, so it is even more extraordinary that in this price environment and the challenges it presents, that PetroStar and their parent company, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, are investing over $20 million today on an asphalt expansion in North Pole, which is scheduled to come online this summer. So creating increased uncertainty with this provision causes understandable concern. Now there are plenty more aspects of this proposal that warrants further discussion, but I just want to conclude by addressing the proposed increase in the interest rate. AOGA supports the current rate and believes it's reasonable, particularly considering the lengthy statute of limitation that provides the Department of Revenue with 6 years to audit a company's production tax return. As Director Alper stated 2 weeks ago, He said, when there is a change in an oil and gas tax return, it is almost always in the state's favor. We're looking for more money. So, to state succinctly and candidly, House Bill 247 fails to encourage increased production, fails to make Alaska more competitive for future investment, and fails to provide stability and predictability. This bill, if passed, without question, will result in lower long-term production and revenues to the state. And on one hand, the administration has said that it is not predicting new or lesser activity through the enactment of this bill. But on the other hand, they will say that it's reasonable to say that corporate decisions might be made differently if a limitation was put on that, meaning tax credits. And Analytica agreed last week, stating that limiting refundable credits would increase capital needs. In this price environment, it will be incredibly challenging to find funding for those increased capital needs. And Analytica went on to say, for projects currently under development, a July effective date would have major adverse impacts. House Bill 247 makes a series of incremental changes that, as Mr. Mayer described, that investors would call it quite scary. He explained last week that incrementally taking more slivers without making fundamental changes to the system, which can actually be more concerning than a wholesale fundamental change, because fundamental changes could be acceptable if industry thought they were going to be stable. But instead, this bill creates, as he said, an oh dear moment. When the environment is tough, folks are going to come back year after year after year to get another slice. So, raising taxes on companies that are already reporting losses or in negative cash flow positions is neither a prudent nor feasible long-term solution and is certainly not sound tax policy in our mind. While we appreciate the need to close the state's fiscal gap, AOGA would advise against taking even more from the oil and gas industry when it is more important for the state to encourage these companies to continue to make critical investments in our collective future. To cripple the industry is a misguided attempt to address short-term concerns that will actually result in long-term harm to the economy. And compounding the negative impact of the highly burdensome changes in the proposal is the provision that all but one of these changes would become effective July 1st. Well, one is retroactive to January 1st. Now, it's almost March, and companies' operational plans for the full calendar year have already begun to be implemented. So contracts for the entire year have already been entered into. Work has commenced, and financial commitments have been made by the companies, all based on the existing tax structure. So any sudden reduction in the tax credits and or increase in the taxes on such short notice would therefore, in effect, truly, in our view, be a retroactive tax change. The money's been spent for the year. So this would result in a long-term serious impact to our industry and have an intensely negative impact on the state's reputation throughout the global banking and financial community. So whether or not the governor's proposal is enacted, the oil and gas industry will still be the largest contributor to state government by far. And let's assume all of the governor's proposals do pass. The oil and gas industry will contribute 7.5 times more than the proposed income tax, 50 times more than the proposed revenue from mining, and 37 times more than from commercial fishing. So, when will it be time for the state to realize that despite the rhetoric and misconceptions, the industry is not immune to financial hardship? Increasing taxes on the industry that is the largest contributor to state government during a time when that industry is suffering major financial loss will result in long-term negative repercussions to the state's overall economy. Forcing the industry to reduce investments through excessive tax increases in today's economic downturn will lead to a reduction of industry jobs, a reduction of oil and gas production, and a certain reduction in future revenues to the state, all of which only serve to exacerbate the revenue crisis the state currently faces. This is not sound tax policy, and it is not in the state's best interest. So in the spirit of let's pull together, and in order to make it through the current economic downturn, we cannot emphasize enough that imposing these tax increases and eliminating access to critical incentives does nothing to increase production. It creates more harm to Alaska's largest industry and the state's economy as a whole. So we're not here before you asking for a tax decrease or for relief while we struggle through these extraordinary low prices. We do ask, however, that you consider that the industry that has supported 85% of Alaska's revenue since statehood, and at this trying time, you do no harm to the long-term viability of the oil and gas industry. So thank you for your patience, Mr. Chairman and committee members, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might
have. Thank you for your testimony, Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Ms. Moriarty, you're a wonderful advocate for the industry, and I appreciate that. One thing, and I'll just sort of rip this Band-Aid and get this out of the way now. You've quoted me, and I think more fairly there should have been a question mark at the end of my quote, because in the slide, I mean, I did indicate some incredulity and surprise at Mr. Mayer's testimony that indeed because we have royalty, we're in arguably a better position. But it certainly wasn't my making a statement of fact. It was just me sort of responding to his testimony, and I wanted to make that clear.
Thank you.
I guess fundamentally my main question is, sitting in this committee for the mining tax and in Chairman Olson's committee on alcohol and tobacco, every single industry, every single one of them, could make the arguments you've made. And what we're left with at the end of the day, even if we use the earnings reserve in some beneficial way to help the people of Alaska, we're left with close to a multi-billion dollar deficit. And the only option, if I take the collective wisdom of all the industries, because there are like 10 of them, the only option left to us is to impose taxes on Alaska people. That's the only way. So how do you respond to that? You talked about pulling together at the end of your statement. How do you respond to my comment?
Thank you, Representative Josephson. Through the chair, it is a very challenging position that you are faced with, without a doubt. What we are saying as the oil and gas industry, however, that if you try to raise taxes on us and mining and fishing, and I agree, I listened to the mining testimony last week. In fact, I called my colleagues, Karen and DeAntha, and said, hey, I think I could take your testimony and make it mine. Because the points are the same. In a low commodity price environment, when industry is already struggling, additional taxes will only make a bad situation worse. And for the state to be taxing your largest economic drivers will not increase the feeling that maybe Alaska is going into a recession. Now, there is some speculation, are we in a recession or are we not? But you know, people are nervous, people are feeling that, you know, things are maybe not going in the right direction. And all we're here to tell you is that increasing taxes on the industry will compound the problem in a different way. You know, it may not help you short term, it may help you short term for the state's revenue, but that's going to have repercussions. Because remember, every direct job impacts 20 more jobs throughout the economy. And so we create 11 public sector jobs right now for every job that we create. So it's a delicate balance, without a doubt. And you're in a very tough position. I'm just here to tell you the impact it will have on our industry.
Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to the slide where North Slope production is stable, that one. you made a comment about the difference is 50,000 barrels, and I'm just trying to figure out where you're getting that number. And then if you can also comment, I just want to remind folks that that fall 2013 forecast was after the previous administration decided to change the way they do forecasting and come out with a more conservative approach. So I think it's not entirely genuine to use those numbers in the way that you were suggesting. And I just want to find out where you're getting the 50,000 number from.
So, Representative Tarr, through the chair, the 50,000 number comes straight from the forecast. So, this is, and that's all we can rely on. Whether they've changed their methodology or not, I can't control that. We don't predict, I mean, you wouldn't believe it if you relied on our production forecast anyway. So, we rely on the state's forecast. Mm-hmm. And the state's forecast, if you look for 2020, mm-hmm. said that we would have just under 400,000 barrels per day. Mm-hmm. And technically, it's actually closer to 60,000 that they're mm-hmm. forecasting now that we will have in 2020. I can't mm-hmm. speak to the methodology. I can't. We can't control that. All we can do is tell you that the forecast after Senate Bill 21 was passed and while the public was considering the referendum, mm-hmm. that forecast for 2020 was almost 400,000 barrels per day, and now the forecast is for 460. But you can certainly see that production has stabilized. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I think for 2015, I think production was around 519,000 barrels per day, mm-hmm. and that's what the exact the forecast is for this fiscal year. Mm-hmm. So it has stabilized.
Just a brief follow-up, Mr. Chairman. I think that's an issue that we should revisit with Ken Alper and just to talk that through, because that was very much that conversation under the previous administration, you know, in the way it was reported in the news, you know, was a methodology they suggested was done in partnership with the industry, that you did actually have some influence over that change.
So, Representative Tarr, through the chair, the industry always has input on the forecast. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that we do not. They had input under every single administration. It's how the department comes up with this forecast, is they take the information that industry shares with them. I'm just saying if you used our production forecast numbers, which we don't release because we don't talk about it collectively, because that would break antitrust rules. We can't talk about production and price forecasts. So that's why we rely on the Department of Revenue. So they always take what the industry tells them mm-hmm. and makes a forecast.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was a pretty controversial change, as I recall, and a lot of question about how that might be manipulated and how we would review those numbers going forward. So I hope that we can hear from the department on that as well.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, this bill contains a lot of different features, as you've talked about. Some are actually tax increase, and I think you saw a quote on that, the floor going from 4 to 5. Mm-hmm. But, you know, those comments that were made were not exclusively over the entire bill. I guess I'm most concerned about the tax credits. I mean, we're talking about state expenditures on the reimbursable tax credits. And, of course, just like industry cuts its expenditures when they are having problems with money, the tax credits are a direct expenditure from the state of Alaska as reimbursable cash to companies. And so, as Representative Hawker said, we're relying on you to come forward and tell us what the specific impact of those credits or elimination of those credits are on individual projects, because there's no way for us to sit here and know what those are. But I guess the interesting thing that we saw from the Cook Inlet credits, which is basically the largest portion of what we're talking about in money on the consultants, Analytica on slide 16, showed that in a constrained market, which is what we're talking about, we're not talking about trying to build an export market. We're talking on gas. The net present value to the state of those credits was negative $125 million to $50 million, $60 million net loss if we expend those credits over the full life of the project. And so the state would never even recover its capital expenditure on those if we do those credits. And that was slide 16. And I guess the other thing that our consultant said was that worldwide, a high price on gas at the $5 to $6 per MCF range was sufficient support to make even the most challenged gas deposits profitable and economic. And so we have that situation where we're at about, estimated about 7 in Cook Inlet. And so we're trying to figure out how we go forward with these expenditures when they seem to be not needed in a higher gas price environment as Cook Inlet is, to make these gas projects economic. So can you explain to me how eliminating those tax credits while you still have a high-priced gas market is going to what the effect of that is going to be on those projects where our consultant said a $5 to $6 gas price was sufficient to economically develop everything that we needed as long as we were not, yeah, that's what, okay. For domestic supply.
So Representative Seaton, through the chair, can I just have you
sure.
kind of restate that to make sure your question, just to make sure I'm answering.
Sure.
There's a lot of comment in there, so I just want to make sure I'm answering the part of the question that you're trying to get to.
Sure, and through the chair. There were two portions of the support that's needed for economic development of projects. Mm-hmm. One was tax credits, and the other was a higher priced environment in gas. Both the administrations and our consultants said that a higher price of gas is sufficient economics to do the projects. And then we load on the expenditure of the tax credits, and I'm trying to figure out why, if the industry, if the higher priced gas is enough to make that project economic, what is the effect of eliminating the tax credits?
Okay. Thank you for that. So, Representative Seaton, through the chair, you are going to hear tomorrow from people that operate in Cook Inlet specifically, and they will talk specifically and answer that question without a doubt. What I can tell you categorically from the industry as a whole is that the elimination of the tax credits will have a negative impact on those investments, especially in having it effective July 1st. So as I mentioned in my testimony, the companies are moving forward with projects. And I think there is a project that's going to be talked about tomorrow from Bluecrest that's specifically a gas project that is specifically on hold because of the uncertainty surrounding whether the tax credits are going to be there or not. So regardless of the price environment for gas, as a whole, the industry is still in a negative cash flow position. So making those investments in this time frame is still very challenging. And I think you'll hear more specific to those projects as a whole, because I'm not the project experts. I mean, that's what the folks behind me will testify to. All I can say is that the tax credits were absolutely necessary to bring those companies here. You wouldn't have had the hundreds of millions of dollars of investment over the last 6 years that have increased the Kenai Peninsula Borough's tax revenues and increased the workforce and property values in that community without the tax credit. So that is unequivocally, unabashed, we can say that.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Ms. Moriarty, know that, for example, on the Agrium bill, I supported that bill, mm-hmm. Even though it was going to mean a reduction in some respects to the state. I saw that the case was made. So I see your point of view on this. I do. However, I'm curious about something, your response to something that Mr. Mayer said, I believe, in his first day of testimony that really struck me, really stuck with me. He seemed to say, and I think I'm paraphrasing him right, that even the industry in Cook Inlet believes, or believed, and it was as if he had communicated with someone in the industry, that the tax credits that exist there are not sustainable. They're too, essentially, the implication or inference of what he said was they're too generous, and that even the industry has a sense of that. Do you have any response to Mr. Mayer's comments? Because that's what I heard from him.
So, Representative Josephson, through the chair, I did not have any direct conversation with Mr. Mayer.
Okay.
I believe that he did have conversations with individual companies. I don't know which ones he talked to and which ones he didn't. Mm-hmm. So I would just encourage you to ask the Cook Inlet companies that question tomorrow, and who he talked to and who he didn't talk to. So I didn't have any communications with Mr. Mayer since two sessions ago.
Thanks.
Representative Heron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Carol's, I appreciate this page and then the four policy questions that you have later in your deck. To say the least, when this bill makes its way out of this committee, the governor's bill will be, it won't be the governor's bill. It'll be changes to it. So I guess what I'd like you to do, if you could, in your position on these specific concerns, obviously, there must not be any good points that you've put on that sheet, but describe the bad ones that we should discard and the ugly ones that we should work on.
Well, Representative Heron, through the chair, you're correct. There are no good ones on the slide, and it is impossible to tell you which ones are evil and which ones are bad and which ones are just sort of ugly. The good, bad, and the ugly, because for various companies, the proposals will have different impacts based on the company. And so what we're saying holistically as the trade association, what we can do is lay out for you that all of these changes will have a negative impact on every single company. So for we'll just take the very first one. Increasing the minimum tax by at least 25%. For a company who's already paying the minimum tax, they're faced with a 25% hit. For a company that isn't paying a tax right now but has production but they haven't made a profit or they're excluded because of a small producer exclusion, they go from 0 to 5. So for Company A, who's already paying the tax, it's a 25% hit. For a company who doesn't pay it now, it's has been described as an infinite increase. And don't get me to explain that whole mathematical equation. But the point is, all of these changes have a different impact based on the company. So that's why I think you're going to have all of these companies testify, because it all impacts them differently.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Looking at this from your first couple slides through the chair, Ms. Moriarty, and I was struck by this when I went to the luncheon, I thank you for it, in January,
mm-hmm.
Because in some respects I would think the industry would like the fact that the state is trying to wean itself from dependence, that would be a good thing from the industry standpoint. And at the same time, sometimes I feel like every time we're trying to be the 18-year-old moving out of the house, as it were, the industry wants to remind us that, no, you can't leave. You must stay with us. Do you have any response to that comment? I know it's a little bit abstract.
So, Representative Josephson, through the chair, let me try. We would love for the state to have a diversified economy. Make no mistake about it. Yes, we have been, I don't know how you described it, but yes, we have been the largest contributors to state government. That hasn't been by our choice. That's been by the policy put in place by the state, for that to be your choice, for us to have that role. Now, we take that very responsibly, and we are good corporate citizens. We have, one thing we tried to quantify for this testimony, which is virtually impossible is the amount of community service collectively our industry employees provide. But yes, we would love to have a diversified economy, but increasing taxes on us as a way to try to solve a fiscal crisis does not provide any stability or predictability in our mind. Because all we see as the industry is you raise taxes when prices go up, you raise taxes when prices go down. What's going to happen next year if you pass everything and you're still $1 billion short for whatever reason? So does that mean you're going to come back to us again and again and again? So yes, we would love to have a diversified economy, but from our viewpoint, this bill does not provide us stability.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look at this as, you know, pay me now or pay me later. We can extract the wealth from the oil industry now and lose it later because of lack of production and those areas of things that we're going to be missing out on, the exploration and all that. And I'd like to see some effort spent on the loss of production versus taking the money now, versus loss of production. Some of that balance that I think we're missing here. We're going to, in some way or another, whether we increase the tax and get the money now, lower production, lose the money later, there's a decision here that's going to cost us. And the decision that I'm faced with is, do we take it now when we, quite frankly, have more savings than we will maybe in 10 years when the lack of production really catches up and we really drop down and TAPS becomes an issue? So I'd like to see some kind of analysis on the now versus later, what we're foregoing in revenue by doing this now based upon expiration and investment and all those things. And I haven't seen a lot of that yet. And so I'd like to kind of be able to do that kind of apples-to-apples comparison, including the cost of money and all of that. And it's missing for me.
And thank you, Representative Johnson, through the chair. You know, Representative Hawker pointed out that the administration was expecting us to talk about the impacts, and we are. But what you're talking about is something we as an industry can't really do, because we can take the state's projections and we could make assumptions, but it would be much better if you had a third party, whether it be Econ One or Wood Mackenzie or Analytica, if they have that ability, because then it comes from a third party. And because otherwise, if we come up and say, well, if you pass this bill, you're going to have 50,000 less, and I mean, where's the credibility then if it's coming from us? But if you had a third party analysis, I think we would encourage that and would hope that would happen, but we're not in the right position to be the one to do it.
Yeah, and I guess, is my assessment accurate? I mean, is it truly you can't have your cake and eat it too? If we raise taxes, production will drop. If we don't raise taxes, investment and production will go up, and it's a timing issue. So am I wrong with that assessment? I mean, am I off base?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, no, you're not. I mean, I think, you know, as Janet Weiss from BP, and she's our board chair, and I think she talked about it when we were down here last month in January, it's that tipping point. And where is the tipping point? Sure, you can increase taxes on us, but how is that going to impact investment decisions? It's going to impact your production 4 to 5 to 10 to 15 years from now, and we're already in a cash negative position. So I think you can't mess around with it too much, or we're at our tipping point, and you will have long-term consequences.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. A little bit of a segue off of Representative Johnson's question, but Kara, you know, we all know, and you testified specifically to it a few minutes ago, that the industry participants themselves are actively and regularly engaged with the Department of Natural Resources and to some degree the Department of Revenue in the preparation of the revenue sources book by providing access to a certain amount of confidential production information. And I'm just really curious, have the members of your organization been continuing to work with the state towards the spring update on the revenue sources book? And provided information as to the potential decreases that we can in production that we can expect to see if these if this legislation is enacted?
Representative Hawker, through the chair, as you mentioned, those are confidential conversations that the companies have with the Department of Revenue. My guess is they're ongoing. The companies all have ongoing relationships with all of our regulatory agencies, whether it's Revenue or DNR or AOGCC. I can't speak to those specific conversations, and so that's another good question for the companies.
Thank you very kindly.
Representative Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Moretti, through the chair, what do you make of the concern that's been raised by the department, here the Department of Revenue, and it may have been raised by others, that in terms of predictability and sort of forecasting what might happen, that given that the statute and given that the current operating budget only funds 10% of the credits that are or likely to be requested for repayment, that I guess what I'm wondering is, given that the statute affords the governor the statutory authority to only pay 10%, doesn't that in itself create some anxiety that augurs for or supports that we should have greater balance so that the likelihood of payment is there for the industry?
And Representative Josephson, through the chair, this bill doesn't provide any more further stability to that. This bill could be passed and you could have all of the problematic provisions, the $25 million limit, the in-state hire, the $10 billion that companies with gross revenues more than $10 billion can't pay, the fact you can't have it against your net operating loss, you don't, all of those things could go in place, and next year the governor could only put in $40 million for the tax credit fund if that was the 10% number. So for our standpoint, this bill provides no stability, it provides no predictability, and no certainty.
Thank you. And it's difficult because, just looking forward, but, if we have 8,000 barrels per day increase of production in Cook Inlet, and we're about $400 million of tax credits, that's 2,920,000 barrels of increased production for $400 million. And if we extend those tax credits at that rate and have that kind of continued production, then that would be $136 per barrel. So is that the kind of investment that, even if it's a factor of 10, that you would expect the state could continue to do as an industry, that kind of price support by extending credits based on the amount of production that we're receiving?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, it all goes back to what was happening to production before those credits were in place. And is that the type of production you want for Cook Inlet and for the state of Alaska? And what we're saying is those credits have been essential in increasing production. They have been essential in providing more royalty and production, or in property tax and corporate income tax, both to the state and to the local governments. And they are providing jobs. And so it's the policy that you set, and the industry will respond to it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So I guess when the math comes down, would industry expect us to give credit price support of $136 a barrel, which is the increased production that we've seen for that kind of credit support in Cook Inlet?
And Representative Seaton, through the chair, again, that's your policy. We will respond to whatever policy you have in place, and that's what we do.
And Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
I guess you're in here testifying that we should keep the credits in place, and that policy is what we should keep in place for credit support for additional production in Cook Inlet. And I guess if that's your testimony, that's fine. And if you're just saying we should figure out what's good for us and just take that that policy decision, that's fine too. But
Representative Seaton, through the chair, what I'm saying is the policy that you have in place has increased production. And if you think that's a good policy and if that's what you would like to continue, then you probably should keep the Cook Inlet tax credits in place. If you want to make modifications to the credits, then we will modify our response to that, okay. Which may or may not, which will likely have an impact on investment and production.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, Carrie. You just confused me horrifically with your response to Rep. Seaton here, and that is, as I heard the question to you was, we're getting an additional, what was it, 8,000 barrels? What was the?
8,000 barrels a day.
A day production,
yeah.
Now, today. And we have invested the state 400-some millions of dollars of front end of credits. My point being, aren't a lot of those credits, both exploration credits as well as front end loaded credits on establishing a level of production, that in fact the production that we're talking about, it didn't cost us that much to get this production today. Investing that much results in a long-term stream of production that will go on for years and years and years that do not require an equal level of support. But if we want, and I seem to hear you say that, no, we have to put that same amount in every year to get that same amount of production every day.
Well, and Representative Hawker, through the chair, I may have misunderstood Representative Seaton's question. What I heard was, here's the amount of credits that are going in. Do you think that that is sustainable? And my response was, it has worked to increase production. It has worked to increase investment that will have an increased production over the life of those fields and investments, whether it's $440 million for another, 6 years, I don't know that, because in some ways this credit conversation, the price environment will self-correct itself. I mean, in this price environment, people are going to reduce their investments, and that's going to be a reduction on the amount of credits paid whether you change the system or not. I mean, it's just market economics. I mean, unfortunately, we'd like to keep the same level of spend, but when price is only $30, it's probably not going to be the same level of spend. So, maybe I misunderstood the question, but my point was, is we think the credits have been very important for Cook Inlet production and investment.
Mr. Chair, and if I might, I think we're still kind of apples and oranges on this, but it's really not a question for you. I unfortunately am not going to be here to be able to query some of the folks that come. I hope they that are sitting here might take the opportunity to address the front-loaded nature of credits and the long-term nature of production that arises from those credits and without my being here to prompt them. So I just hope somebody might think to bring that up. Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just, kind of thinking of this, say, from the perspective of my constituents, I just want to hear your reaction. And one example, Hillcorp made, front page news for giving $100,000 bonuses to their employees to the tune of over $100 million. And how do you sort of reconcile, that kind of information with, sort of how can you expect the Alaska public to react to information like that and then, respond that they think, that company is hurting?
So Representative Tarr, through the chair, my response to your constituents, and I don't work for Hillcorp, and they're going to be up here tomorrow, but I will tell you that was a five-year commitment that the company made to their employees, and even in this tough economic time, they decided to honor that commitment to their employees. So to me, that says the company cares about their workforce. In respect to the larger situation that we find ourselves in the state being in a deficit, and the fact that we're asking for no additional increases on the industry, it's because if you look back at that slide, Hillcorp purchased some fields on the North Slope, and they are part of that $52 a barrel. And so right now they have a negative cash flow of around $22 per barrel. and you're asking them to add cost to that at a time when it will cause them to impact either their capital spend or their operational spend. And so if you want the policy of Alaska to be to raise taxes on an industry that has negative cash flow, then that's your prerogative. But what we're saying is that that policy will impact their investment and production.
And Mr. Chairman, just as a comment, I mean, what I can tell you that my constituents say is they don't see it as tough times for a company like that when they read about over $100 million in employee bonuses. And good for them that they were in a position to do that, but just the reaction is that that doesn't ring the alarm bells that, that bad things are happening to them.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I think that you could also then point to the fact that industry is hurting if you look at layoffs that other companies in Alaska has had to make. And there have been several hundred jobs lost from ConocoPhillips and BP and others in the state. And if these prices continue and if you have additional taxes, you will see more job loss in Alaska.
And it's the same thing as private and public sector. They honor their commitment to the people who work hard. Even the state does that. Yes, they do. They give them raises every year. And so, it's the same thing. Work, and then you get compensated. And you don't think it's the same thing, it's the same thing. When you get low money, but you're still giving raises to, it's the same thing to me if you're asking about bonuses to or whatever to their employees. To me, that's my opinion.
Mr. Chairman, and just as a comment, I guess without getting us into a conversation about that, I mean, actually the action of the legislature until the final negotiations last year was to not honor those. So that's probably not our best example.
We have many other presenters, so any final questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
We'll take a brief at ease to hear from the next presenter.
That's neat.
I'm meeting back to order 234, the presenter. Welcome, Mr. Armstrong. Armstrong Oil and Gas. Mr. Armstrong is the chairman and CEO of Armstrong Oil and Gas. Please identify yourself for the record, please, and continue.
Hello. I'm Bill Armstrong with Armstrong Oil and Gas, and the president of Armstrong Oil and Gas. And I want to thank everybody for the opportunity to be here today.
Go ahead.
Just go ahead. Okay. I don't have any prepared remarks, so I thought I would just come here and just talk to you guys from the heart. And I don't have a fancy PowerPoint presentation, so instead I thought it'd be a lot more interesting just to do kind of a general question and answer. And I really want you guys to ask me all the things that we can talk about. Where the price of oil is, where the price of oil is headed. You guys probably all read Petroleum News last week about our recent discovery, our recent announcement of our discovery in up on the North Slope. And I'd love to talk to you about that. I want to talk to you obviously about the state's oil tax policy, specifically HB 247, and what I think the state needs to do. And then I want to talk about taps and the oil flowing down taps, but I want to have this be kind of a general discussion. But before I do all that, I just want everybody to know that how much I love Alaska. And we have been here now for 15 years. First came here in 2001. And the state and my companies have really worked well together. And it's been a great mutually beneficial relationship. The first ever independently operated and produced oil field on the North Slope was a field called Ugarit Field. Ugarit Field was conceived of, originated, assembled, and basically created in my company. I brought a partner out of Dallas, Texas, up here, Pioneer Natural Resources, and we put it on production. The second field ever found in Alaska. By the way, that field's the sixth biggest field on the North Slope now. It's going to get bigger. The second field ever put on production in the North Slope was a field that was originated in my office, created by us, assembled by us, and that field's called Nikechik Field. And I brought Kerr McGee and then ultimately E and I in for that field. And that field is now the fourth biggest field on the North Slope of Alaska. And recently, my partner Repsol out of Spain, have drilled a series of 16 wells up on the North Slope over the last 4 years, and we have found a really great field, number of fields, but one really great field that we believe might be the second biggest field ever found ever on the North Slope. We think it's bigger than Alpine, which is the biggest field found in the United States in 30 years, and we're going to surpass that field, and we might catch Kuparuk River, which is over a 3-billion-barrel field. So that little preamble for y'all is mainly, I just want you to know that we're a private company, and I put my money where my mouth is. And I believe in the state. I believe in the potential of the state, and I believe in the state's future is very bright, and its best days are ahead of it, not behind it. So, with that little introduction, Representative Nagyek, I'd love to answer any questions you guys might have.
Any questions for Mr. Armstrong? Representative.
Thank you. Bill, good to see you again, as always.
Good to see you, too, Representative.
You know, you alluded to the high prospectivity of your Colville Delta projects here. I'd love to think we heard that potentially could be providing numbers I've heard out of DNR, potentially 100,000 barrels a day. And again, that's public knowledge that people have talked about that.
Yep.
You've talked about it. They've talked about it. That's a lot of oil. That's a wonderful thing. But I've also, that's a really environmentally sensitive and difficult area to develop. Can you give us some sort of confidence of your ability to overcome the environmentalist objectives?
Sure.
Objections?
Objections.
And the objective, of course, to stop you.
Right. Okay, yes. First of all, it is, just to be clear, our discovery up there, which we call PICA, and I really hope to change that name. That's just really such a lousy name. I mean, it's better than Oguruk and Nikechik, but it's not a great name. But anyway, so our discovery, which we call PICA, lies, as the crow flies, directly between Alpine Field and Kuparuk River Unit. So we're not talking about a particularly massively sensitive area like you would, let's say, Lake Teshapuk or the Chukchi Sea or areas that have very, very high profile. ConocoPhillips and ARCO have done a terrific job of already showing that they can develop the resource within the Delta. They already have five pads within the Delta. Our first three pads that we're planning on developing are east of the river, not in the Delta. So it would be quite frankly, we elected to go with an EIS, environmental, EIA, as opposed to an EA, and that was at the request of the DNR and the Nuiqsut Village and the Native Corps. Although we didn't feel like we needed to, we're going to use the technology that has been used, just kind of stamp it out technology that's already been used at Alpine Field. So simple gravel roads, oil on vertical support members, small pads, long reach wells. So I don't expect much in the way of environmental impact, and nor do I expect much in the way of objections to what we're doing.
Oh, congratulations. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. So let me tell you a little bit about PICA. And this is probably the theme I want you guys to take away from this meeting more than anything. And that is, when we came to Alaska in 2001, for the most part, the big guys had written off Alaska with potential. BP had decided they weren't going to drill any more Wildcat wells. Exxon, same. And Conoco was still doing some things out in the NPRA and out west by Alpine. But I think the general thesis was that all the big fields had been found, and therefore you didn't have a lot of hope. You had a pipeline that was declining, you know, really regularly. It had peaked out at 2 million barrels a day and was on its way down to something non-commercial, basically. And we didn't believe that. And so we found a Gook field, and then we found a Kachik field. And now this new field we found has got multiple pays. It's very shallow. It's old-fashioned. It's old school. It's like 23% porosity with 150 feet of pay, huge oil column. We don't know how big it's going to get because it's not totally appraised yet, but we know we've already found well over a billion barrels in this. The wells are going to be good, fast production, and we have the potential of really adding a jolt, a big jolt to TAPS. And, I mean, let's talk about TAPS for a moment. I mean, that pipeline, that awesome engineering feat, that huge pipeline, is starting to get difficult to produce because the volume of oil going down it. And they're talking about heating it up, and they're talking about putting in more pigs and more compressors or all these various ways of trying to keep TAPS going. But the best way to keep TAPS going is more oil. And Carrie showed you that decline curve a minute ago about the North Slope. We're not going to flatten that decline curve. We're going to increase it. And our field, which we found, is really good, and it's going to last a long time. So we're very proud of it. And it wasn't hard to see. It was very difficult to see, but we were able to see it. And Rapsol and I have put a lot of effort into that. I think we're 7 penetrations in one zone appraised, 4 in another zone, multiple other zones that are behind, we don't even talk about. But it's really awesome. And so I guess what I want to really point out to all of y'all, and that is, as a group, as a state, you guys have got to get wells drilled. You just have to get wells drilled. If you're not getting wells drilled, you're not finding oil. And I've shown, I'm living testimony, that when you drill wells, you find it. Mm-hmm. And absolutely, there's an unmitigated rule in the energy business, the oil business. If you don't drill a well, you're not going to find any oil. So you got to drill. You can use your sports metaphor all day long. If you don't shoot, you don't score. You know, if you don't dump it into the net, don't dim it, the puck towards the net, it doesn't go in. If you don't hit if the ball doesn't get to the hole, it doesn't go in. If you're not drilling, you're not finding. And there is so much room up on the North Slope, specifically, to find fields like we have found. And I know a lot of experts said we couldn't do it, but we did. And there's more. And what we need is the encouragement, better permitting regulations, easier access to the lands, et cetera, to be able to come out there and drill more wells. And it's not a diminishing asset. It can go up. We've seen it in the United States in the lower 48, and we're standing up on the North Slope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, we'll follow up. How would you respond to someone who might say that, you know, listening to you here about the incredible prospectivity of the PICA project, the great potential it has, frankly, it's your optimism and excitement about it. How would you respond to folks that say, well, it sure sounds like you don't need any state financial incentives to continue with this development?
Well, first of all, without the state's incentives, I doubt I would have come up here in the first place. So I look all over the world for opportunities. And when I came up to Alaska, I'm sorry, I didn't represent Representative Hawker through the chair. I'm sorry, I didn't follow the rules there precisely. If I didn't know the, what the state was offering from the standpoint of NOL credits, et cetera, then I might not have been up here. Because we can go anywhere. The competition that you have, the state has, it's not with other oil companies. It's with other regions. And, like, for example, right now, with the price of oil in this ridiculous swoon that it's in, by the way, it won't last. No chance. I 100% can guarantee you this price dip won't last. Now, I can't tell it's going to be over with tomorrow or even this year, but it is coming back, probably with a vengeance, and probably something even higher than what I think y'all are predicting. But if you look around the world at what people are doing to their oil industry, pretty much across the globe, with a few exceptions, people are making terms better. They're giving tax incentives. They're retrading their policies. I had one of my investment banking groups throw together a slide for me before I came here today on this, and you can go down the list. Great Britain, Scotland, Australia, China, even Russia, Mexico, for God's sakes. They're all making things better, with the exception of three countries that I could find: Congo, Madagascar, and Tanzania, and Alaska. Three countries and a state. So to make things worse when things are bad is, you're kind of in rare company. So,
you allow me a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And thank you. So specifically to the North Slope, is any way you can identify, say specifically in particular, what state incentives made it possible for you to come here and what keeps you here? And secondly, could you distinguish that? You've got great experience in the Cook Inlet as well.
Yep.
And so could you separate your comments and offer any counsel to us on how to keep the Cook Inlet developing?
Well, you know, as you know, we were in Representative Hawker through the chair. As you know, in the Cook, we were active there for 4 or 5 years. And we were active in the Cook because of the credits. It was a confluence of events, and you didn't have to be much of a rocket scientist to predict. The production in the Cook was dropping like a rock, and you knew exactly what South Central needed, you know, to keep the schools heated and the hospitals open. And there was a day of reckoning that was going to come within half a dozen years or so. And you all put together a series of very generous tax credits in the Cook. And I've even told, I think even to this body, it was the greatest tax regime on the planet, what you did in the Cook Inlet. But it worked. Look at it. I mean, nobody's talking about South Central going dark and cold now. So we were able to put together a project that was about 100 BCF field, built a 25-mile pipeline, hooked it up, sold into the Cook Inlet, the South Central market. And then, of course, you bring Jeff Hildebrand in town with Hillcorp. He's a world-class oil guy, and he's come in and crushed it. Now, I'm not working at Cook anymore, and I haven't really been spending much time there. So I don't know, are you out of the woods? You know, I'm not sure how long you're out of the woods. I don't really have an opinion on the credits down there, but I will say the credits worked. But I don't really have an opinion about saying whether they're still needed. So the first part of your question, I think, was about the North Slope.
More correct, sir.
And the slope is, I came here in 2001, and so I've had the privilege or the disprivilege of having five different tax regimes on the North Slope since we've been there, which, by the way, is extremely unusual. I mean, everywhere I work, and for the most part, it tends to be in the United States. And I can't ever remember Colorado or Wyoming or Oklahoma or Louisiana or Texas or anybody changing their tax laws. It just is what it is. And when I came here in 2001, there was a good tax law in place. It's a production tax with the ELF. And the ELF is what attracted me here because it did give you an opportunity if you had a non-giant field to have a really good tax regime. And then I believe it was Murkowski who put in PPT. And that was kind of the beginning of kind of the progressive kind of quasi-windfall profits tax. And then things just went completely off the rails with ACES. And if you recall, I left the state from 2006 through 2009 or 10 because it was ridiculous. There was no way you could make any money with ACES. And but the one thing, great thing about ACES is it was so bad. It was so bad that you knew it was going to get reformed. And so we came back up here. I met with Sean Parnell, Governor Parnell at the time. And I remember saying to him in a meeting, I said, I know you're going to reform ACES in some way, shape, or form because this is an unsustainable tax regime. And sure enough, he did reform it. And by the way, SB 21, it's good, guys. It's working. It's working. And the problem is, so then it goes from PPT to ACES. Then we go into SB 21, what they call it now, MAPA, I think it's called. And then no sooner had we passed SB 21, and then we got slapped with the referendum. And I didn't even know that was possible. I didn't know you could even do a referendum. I need to talk to my lobbyist. He should have told me that he could do that. But so the referendum came down the pike, and then that thing lasted about 9 months or whatever, and it was defeated. And then so people now realize, like, wait a minute. SB 21, which, by the way, is a very complicated tax law. I don't know about y'all, but I have a hard time understanding it. And I got a lot of really smart guys that work for me. They do that for me. But SB 21 finally made Alaska competitive with your competition, which is ostensibly the lower 48. And look at that. In that period of time, you brought in us back. You brought Jim Musselman, who's a world-class explorer with Kalis. You brought Jeff Hildebrand into the Cook and then up to the North Slope with Hillcorp. He's a world-class oil guy, too. And it was the beginning of people coming up here. And no sooner had SB 21 finally been in place than, wham, here comes price collapse in oil. So the lifespan of SB 21 is during this collapse. And so the idea that you could possibly make any kind of opinion about SB 21 in this environment, I mean, everybody's, it's just like a bunch of rats leaving a sinking ship everywhere. It's not just Alaska. It's all through the lower 48. It's in every exploratory region. I mean, everybody's dropping rigs like crazy. So you can't take a window and look at SB 21 right now and say that it was working, but you can't say it's not. So does that answer your question there, Representative?
Well, it's just, you know, thank you very much. I have always appreciated your unabashed honesty and willing to tell us exactly what you think. And it's refreshing. Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think, and this is a nice segue from your previous comments, one of the things we're trying to figure out is just the specific impact to your current projects if we make some changes right now. So to the extent you can share information with us on that, that would be of interest. And then just in comparing some of the different tax regimes, I mean, you were saying ACES was really bad. One of the things that we were concerned about during that time was companies like yourself, because the way the capital credits were structured, it was really generous on that side of things, which net operating loss, I guess, is supposed to sort of be the equivalent. And I think the other thing we're trying to figure out, again, with little information, is sort of, you know, as a whole, do credits work? I think we're in agreement about that, right. And say Cook Inlet, great example. But are the credits that we're using incentivizing the behaviors that we want? And so you had an earlier comment about you want people drilling wells. You know, explain in the context of your work, you know, what credits are favorable and, you know, could we even do a better job if we looked at, you know, different pieces?
Oh, you can do a way better job. You can just give 100% credit for every dry hole that was drilled. How about that? I'm only kidding. Kind of. The big one in the right now is the 35% net operating loss credit, because that enables us to be able to weather the time it takes between drilling the wells and getting production online, and that is a huge impact on us. And I don't want to make anybody, any oil guys behind me mad about this. I just think exploratory credit or the small producer credit is kind of peanuts in the scheme of things. Mm-hmm. The way you define an exploratory well, it was so egregious that, for the most part, except for maybe the Smith Bay well that Kalis is drilling this year, most wells never really qualified as exploratory wells, just the way it was defined.
Okay.
That's the main one. That's the one we're most concerned about now, when you really look at the effect of HB 247. Mm-hmm. By the way, we have an internal name for HB 247. It's called Hellbent 24/7 to run every oil company off of the North Slope. That probably wasn't the right thing to say to this group, but. You're helping at 24/7 to run us off the North Slope. Why you pick 247 as your three numbers, I'll never know.
My guess.
It just fit. I'm sorry, it just fit.
Representative Olson.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, it's always a pleasure when you come to town because you usually have some good news for us. But I'd like to address the Cook Inlet Stampede for a second. It was primarily Tom Wagner's baby, and I know when he first started talking about it, I thought he was crazy. Then he started making more and more sense. Ultimately, as you say, it did work. It really turned into a real asset. But it didn't really attract that much attention outside. You're one of the first people who have come in a long time and have mentioned the effect from outside the state. Energy Council, periodically, somebody will say they liked it and they've taken something from it. But I would agree with your assessment on House Bill 247. I had heard that the only place it was being used was in several third world countries, and I thank you for confirming that.
Okay.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Armstrong, first of all, you should look for a referendum, because this Hellbent 24/7 would be a winner. I might even.
Representative.
No, the Hellbent 24/7 running us out of off the slope, I think that's a winning campaign slogan. I might even have that on my.
Okay.
But I do want to ask you about one thing, and that's sort of the historic timing of Armstrong. You said that you came up in 2001, you've been here 15 years. What were the incentives that you found attractive in 2001?
Okay. Great question. Representative Justin, through the chair. That's a great question, and it's probably the most important thing that keeps me here, and that is your state is blessed with the greatest petroleum system, one of the best petroleum systems in the world. And when you look at, so how do I say this? When you look below ground in Alaska, it is fantastic. All the problems that y'all create, not specifically necessarily y'all, but all the problems that are created, they happen above ground. You know, it has above ground problems with permitting, above ground problems with, you know, environmental extremism, above ground problems with tax laws, with facilities access, da, 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 da. But below ground, it's fantastic. And the North Slope is really not very picked over. It's really not. I mean, unlike so many plays that we work on in the lower 48, where unconventional plays aside, which is a completely different animal, ironically, in 2001, there was hardly even unconventional plays had been invented since 2001. But the slope, in particular, has just got running room galore. And it's not picked over. It's subtle. It's hard to see. But geologically, it is just terrific. So when I came up here in 2001, what was the name of that law y'all put together? It was the charter agreement. Remember the charter agreement? I think it's expired. Representative Hawker, you probably remember the charter agreement. But basically, it was when y'all first started realizing that, oh my, you know, production peaked in 1990-odd, and it's on its way down. You guys loosely put together a charter agreement between the majors and that said to them, you know, ostensibly, y'all have an oligopoly on the North Slope, and we think you guys have been pushing people away by not working with them, land trades, seismic access, well information, blah, 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 blah. And you put together this charter agreement, and it basically was ostensibly a open for business sign. And so I read that charter agreement. I said, hey, maybe Alaska's turned a corner. Maybe, you know, so it was kind of that encouragement that brought me up here. And then when I started looking at all the opportunities, I was just like going, holy cow, this is a really good place to go look for oil and gas. So that's what brought me in 2001.
Just respectfully, since you were...
We're running out of time.
May I respond to that?
Sure.
And sorry. Since I was referenced here, I'll be honest with you, I'm unfamiliar with any such agreement, but I'm just wondering if maybe you're thinking about the BP-ARCO merger agreement?
No, Representative Hawker to the chair, it wasn't that. It wasn't much of an agreement. It was like four pages, and it was loose as... You know, as loose as a prom dress. I mean, it was just it was an open for business thing, and so.
We have run out of time.
Okay.
We will start again at 6 p.m.
Okay.
Our apologies to the remaining companies for the delay, but this is an interesting topic, and so. And we're going to hear as much as we can.
Do you want me to come back at 6?
Yeah, you're going to be back.
Okay.
We are adjourned at 3:05 p.m.